You know our slogan around here is better practice, better life. But we're taking this belief to the next level. And we've recently announced the creation of a new association. It's called the Best Practices Association. Our association celebrates the mindset that is better practice, better life. This mindset celebrates time, healthy living, personal growth, clinical excellence, and impacting the lives of your patients and your team through intentional leadership. In fact, we are the work-life balance experts in dentistry. The BPA will coach independent dental practices like yours to thrive by sharing best practices and operational habits, behaviors, systems, tools, and insight that lead to profitability and sustained growth, and you can still have a life. So if you're a dentist that wants to surround yourself with great thinkers, let us help you create your own version of better practice, better life. Go to actdental.com/BPA or hit the link in the show notes. Hey guys, welcome to the Best Practices Show, where we take a look at the best business practices from the best dental practices all across the country. And I've got a super controversial, touchy subject that we're going to be talking about today that nobody wants to talk about, called embezzlement. And I've got the world's top expert on dental practice embezzlement, David Harris from Prosperident. So do me a favor, grab a pen and hit the share button. We'll see you in a few seconds.
The Best Practices Show with Kirk Behrendt is brought to you exclusively by ACT Dental, the ultimate provider of dental practice management solutions for dentists and their teams. ACT Dental is committed to helping you build a better practice and a better life. If you are looking to grow your production, motivate your team, get back on track, and create the practice you've always dreamed about, look no further. Give us a call at 800-851-8186 or visit us at actdental.com.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Best Practices Show. I am so grateful you're watching, and you're going to love today because we're going to be talking about a very touchy subject, and I've got the world's expert on this particular topic, David Harris, on the subject of embezzlement. Now, a couple things. First of all, we're shooting this live on Facebook. So if you have questions as you're watching this, or even after the broadcast is no longer live, please ask the questions and I'll ask David to go ahead and answer the questions himself. And another thing, before we jump into this, David has agreed to do this interview, but there's a couple things that we cannot do. Number one is we can't talk about methodology. So he's going to let me know if we go down a path where he's like, I can't tell you that, because we certainly don't want to give people that are doing this better secrets or methodologies to do it. So we're going to talk about the actual essence of it and some indicators. Secondly, I have to say this before we get started. I do not subscribe to the fear thing, and nor does anybody on our team. It's all about possibility here. And this is not about creating more fear or killing the thing that makes your practice work the most, which is called trust. This is about what we would just call a screening. You know, it's important to have trust with the people around you, but as a business owner, you have to do some screening every so often, or these mini pathologies will actually turn into a disease. And so we'll talk about that throughout the course of this discussion with David. But David, thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate this.
Oh, I'm looking forward to this. Kirk, you and I are old friends, and love a chance to have a chat with you.
Absolutely. I reached out to you and you're like, yeah, absolutely, I'll do it. But we're not going to create a ton of great secrets out there for people to go ahead and use. Now, I do want to ask you this. How in the world did you get into this? Because I don't think anybody ever gets into this but says, that's what I want to do. You kind of fell into this, didn't you?
I absolutely did. In 1989, I'd left my job. I was sitting at home and thinking about what I was going to do next. And the phone rang, and it was a guy I'd been in high school with who is now a dentist.
Okay.
And he said to me, I think my front desk person's stealing from me and I have no one else to call. So I told him, okay, understand. I'll meet you tonight at your office after work. And I went over to his office. Again, this was 1989. So it was the old pegboard system that some of your audience probably fondly remembers and wish would make a comeback. Mm-hmm. And saw what she was doing fairly quickly, and they got her fired, and the doctor promised to buy me dinner that he never did, but who says that you remember stuff like that?
Right.
And I didn't think another thing of it. I went back to watching TV, and the whole thing kind of vanished from my mind. 2 weeks later, I was going into my own dentist's office for an appointment, and all of a sudden, Kirk, you know how this is going to end. Mm-hmm. I was about to go through the front door, and I looked through the glass, and sitting there on the other side was the same woman that we fired at the other office 2 weeks before.
No way.
So I didn't go in. I turned around and sprinted to the nearest payphone, because in those days, cell phones were like the size of a gym bag. Mm-hmm. And I phoned the office, and I knew I had to get past the gatekeeper and talk to the doctor. So I just, not knowing a whole lot about how dental offices worked at that point, I just identified myself as a local orthodontist. Mm-hmm. And I got put right through, and I got the doctor on the phone, and I said, "It's not Dr. Jensen calling, it's David Harris. I'm the guy who's supposed to be in your chair right now, but let me tell you why I'm not." Mm-hmm. And I told him about what was sitting at his front desk, and he asked me in this panic voice, "What the hell do I do now?"
Right.
And about a sentence and a half later, he hired me, and that's how I got started. As you say, no business plan, no burning desire to spend the rest of my life working with dentists, but I'm quite happy about my accidental fate and how it worked out.
Yeah. And I'm sure you've learned a ton. And let me share these statistics, because this is why your business has grown so fast. This is a business that's built highly on trust. I mean, it really is. Dentists go into dentistry loving the practice of dentistry or the science of dentistry. And then they realize, wow, this is like a business that I have to run. And you really do it when you get started based on trust. And so you hire people that you like, you hire friends, family members, or just somebody you meet the first time, and you put them in a position and you say, go. Without any training, any protocols, any auditing, anything. And they just kind of learn it on their own too sometimes. And this statistic is mind-blowing. 2 out of 3 dentists will be embezzled in their careers. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you said half of the ones that get embezzled the first time will be embezzled a second time. Is that true?
That is true. And the problem with all of these statistics, Kirk, is that the numbers are low. And the reason is that there's some embezzlement that's never detected. Mm-hmm. There's another amount of embezzlement that's detected and never reported to anybody. And both of those are unquantifiables. And so the 2/3 number and the half being repeated victims are based on what's reported.
Right. And so you and I talked about this. I mean, it could be, I mean, you don't have any data for this, but it could be as high as 80%.
If you asked me what I thought and couldn't justify by any kind of statistic, yeah, I would say that 4 in 5 dentists will be touched eventually.
Wow. Now, it has a ripple effect. I mean, you're talking about 8,000 dentists in the United States. Is that correct? About 8,000 dentists will be affected this year alone.
This year. And yeah, it touches every corner of dentistry. It's staff who can't get raises. It's dentists who don't have the money to buy the equipment that they should have. Some people end up leaving the profession over this.
Right.
Some dentists get divorced because of embezzlement because, you know, in the marital context, the spouses blame each other for this. There are lots and lots of effects, and it's caused one murder that I know of. And there are probably other people whose lives have ended prematurely because of this. And I don't mean to be overdramatic, because
right,
that certainly isn't the scenario for most embezzlement victims. But yeah, it touches all of us.
Right. And I'll keep banging this drum, though, too, because, you know, doing our work, we've seen tons of it. Yeah. And it's not so much the financial impact, it's what happens as a result of all of this. And, you know, trust, there's a lot of things that take a long time to repair, if they ever repair. And so the whole point of having this conversation today, again, I'm going to say it over and over again, it's just a screening. Your practice is no different than a human body. You want to make sure that it is optimally healthy for as long as possible. And these little pathologies can become bigger diseases long-term. So walk us through this, David. So if I'm a 32-year-old dentist watching this, first of all, what are some foundational things? And you have an audit you actually do. It's a 37-point checklist. Now, we're not going to go through all 37 today, but give us the reason, or where did this come from? Like, you came up with this probably just from observing all the cases that you've dealt with, right?
Absolutely. And the conceptual underpinning of this comes from a study that the American Dental Association did in 2007. And what the ADA did in that study, Kirk, is they asked embezzlement victims, what let you know that you had a problem? Mm-hmm. And there were a whole bunch of factors. And it was everything from my accountant told me to, you know, a staff member showed up with a car that was obviously beyond what that person could afford on what I pay them. There were a myriad of things that let people know that they were victims. The thing that struck me was that most embezzlement was discovered not because of some kind of financial anomaly. An example of a financial anomaly would be the accountant finding the embezzlement or the day sheets not balancing to bank deposits or something like that. Mm-hmm. When you totaled up all that stuff, it was responsible for the discovery of less than a third of all the embezzlement. More than two-thirds was found because of some kind of behavioral issue.
Go back to that. That's a critical point. Two-thirds were behavioral, and these are probably, I don't know if you heard the question that I was going to ask, but these were pretty much indicators that you've noticed that if any of these indicators are true, it's highly likely, is that fair to say, that you might be experiencing something?
I would never reach a conclusion based on one factor. One of the characteristics that's been observed over and over again about embezzlers is that a lot of them don't like to take vacation.
Okay.
But having said that, there are lots of people who don't want to take vacation and it has some other reason.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you kind of a semi-humorous example. My dad's an attorney. He's 85 years old. You know, he's starting to wind down his practice now, but even last year, he was practicing very full time. My mom's not in the best of health and she really doesn't like to travel. So my dad wasn't taking vacation and I'm pretty sure he wasn't embezzling from his firm, but it was just other circumstances that meant that he really had no particular reason to take vacation.
Yeah.
He and my mom have built their relationship around spending a certain amount of time together. And I don't know that either one of them is really prepared to try increasing it to see what happens. Instead of vacation, he would just stay and work. My point in saying that is that we shouldn't jump to conclusions based on any one factor. You know, we also might see somebody who's working in a dental office who appears to be living beyond their means. Does that mean they're embezzling? Maybe, but not necessarily.
Right.
Because, you know, maybe they inherited some money that we don't know about, or there's some other source of wealth. So the fact that your receptionist shows up with a, you know, a two-year-old BMW that they bought on eBay doesn't automatically mean that they're embezzling.
Right.
So we have to be a little careful about jumping to conclusions. But right, when I see three or four factors together, now we have to start opening our minds a little bit more to the possibility that something might be going on. The embezzlement risk assessment questionnaire that we use started as something we developed internally to help us triage people when they called us. And then eventually we made the decision to make it available to all dentists, because the real problem is, okay, so two-thirds of embezzlement has traditionally been uncovered by behavioral factors. Can we just help dentists get a little better at analyzing those factors?
Right. Now, I want to go through these factors. We're actually going to talk about quite a few of them. But the question I'm burning to ask you, and you and I talked about this beforehand, we've had this conversation before, why do people steal? Because you've gotten to be an excellent student behind the psychology of that.
I've had a little contact. In my experience, people steal for two reasons, and I'll call them need and greed. Needy thieves are exactly what it sounds like. They have some kind of financial imbalance in their life, and they're what's coming into the family is not able to meet what's going out. So it could be that there's some kind of compulsive behavior like gambling addiction or drugs or something like that. It could be, Kirk, just as basic as a divorce.
Mm.
And if you think about the finances of divorce, you have a family with two incomes that's financing one household, and all of a sudden those two incomes have to finance two households. And sometimes that causes the problem. So with needy people, there's some problem. Maybe they perceive it to be temporary, maybe they don't, but it's turned their family finances upside down and this person is stealing to pay the mortgage or to buy groceries.
Mm-hmm.
Greedy people are a little bit different. They are not stealing because of a financial need. They're stealing to address an emotional one.
Explain that.
Let me give you an example. We had an embezzler, one of our alumni, as we call them, and she was stealing, and then she won $3 million in the state lottery.
What?
Here's the interesting part. After she won the $3 million, the amount she was stealing went up. She stole more after she won the lotto than before. So at that point, very clearly, it wasn't about addressing a financial itch. It was an emotional one. The greedy thieves, if I have to profile them in general, they feel underappreciated. they look at the dentist as being a high-functioning idiot with good hands. And the only reason that my doctor is successful, they think, is because I keep her tearful. So they wait for the doctor to come to them and say, Susie, I've been an idiot. I'm going to double your salary starting tomorrow, and I'm going to give you a 30% ownership in the practice. They really, for a while, think that that conversation with the doctor is going to happen. And as time passes and as you know they go for 3 or 4 years and all they get is the cost of living as a pay increase, eventually they realize that that kind of appreciation for their true talents is never going to happen.
Right.
And the next morning they start stealing.
You have a wall of shame. When you talk about your alumni, that's a very nice way to say it. But you've actually profiled people that have, is it crossed the $1 million mark?
Well, actually, we've profiled over 400 embezzlers. And of the 400, yes, we have 7 who belong to that exclusive enclave known as the $1 million club. We also have the less exclusive $500,000 club, and that's got lots of members.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Yeah, the $1 million club is a pinnacle that relatively few embezzlers reach, but enough of them do. We profile them. We, of course, can only talk about embezzlers who have entered the public domain.
Right.
So they've been convicted in court or something. And
right. Now, can this relate? Because I'm sure if you're watching this, you've had one of your credit cards that there's been some activity on it that's not normal. And so this happened to me recently. My card, and so your bank calls you, and what they do is they do a little boom. My bank described it as they do a quick hit to make sure that it works, and they do another quick hit, and then you do another quick hit, and then they go, and then they hit it really hard. So they sample, and they go, ooh, that worked, and then they sample again. Would that be true, is how this works in dentistry?
I think it's a pretty good characterization. When we look back at how people get started initially, I think sometimes the first theft kind of happens by accident. In other words, somebody at the front desk does something that brings in too much money. And they didn't intend to, it just kind of worked out that way. And then they sit there for a little while and wait for somebody to ask for it back. And when it doesn't happen, then they'll try it again. And just exactly like you say, you know, it'll be a small amount. It will be sort of experimental. It will be at the point where if somebody came to them and said, you just did something wrong, they could say, oh, sorry, I made a little mistake. And, you know, whatever money was generated from that, I still have in my hand. So here it is. No blood, no foul, and let's keep going on with life.
Yeah.
So yes, after a couple of nibbles, then they start going at it systematically and aggressively. The other thing you should know about most embezzlers is that the typical thief in a dental office is stealing 3 different ways at once.
Really? Like, give me an example, like 3 different ways. And you don't have to be super specific, but how would that happen in 3 different ways?
Methodology is something that I'm not going to address here, but they all seem to know that if they use any one way of stealing too aggressively, that it will stick out statistically.
Mm.
So they take a little bit this way and a little bit that way, and they try to fly under the radar.
Right.
One number that we do pass out to people sometimes is that the typical embezzler steals somewhere between about 2% and 4% of monthly collections.
Okay.
So if we have an office collecting $100,000 a month, the typical embezzler, and we see outliers on both sides, but the typical embezzler will take $2,000 to $4,000 a month. And they seem to have concluded that that's an amount the doctor wouldn't notice.
Okay. So when you talk about indicators, so let's go right there. So if I'm watching this and I'm thinking, okay, well, hey, I love my team. I love everybody around here, but you know, I do want a healthy business. And even if you're a team member and you want the same, how do we make this work so that it's very healthy? And what are some other indicators that you've seen of the 37 that are important for you to have a conversation or just to clarify yourself as a dentist?
The absolute biggest one is that embezzlers tend to be control freaks. They're territorial about their job, even about their workspace and their computer. And they really don't want anybody else from the office or the doctor intruding into those things. So you can see people who run off their feet more or less with their duties in the office, but they just don't want to delegate to anybody else. They don't want anybody else helping them with this stuff. If they go on vacation, which a lot of them are reluctant to do, they will tell the doctor, and don't let anybody touch my stuff while I'm gone, because they will only mess it up. You know, I'm the only person who can do this properly for you. Kirk, if you think of the matters that you and I have been involved in, the genesis of a lot of them was you or one of your people getting an unusually strong pushback from a staff member.
Yes.
One of the things that scares the crap out of an embezzler is when a consultant comes in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are pretty confident that they can fool their doctor. But when Kirk and his team come in, that's when an embezzler will panic. I've had some very interesting conversations with consultants over the years, including one of yours, who said to me something along the lines of, you know, I've been consulting for a while, and I completely understand that not every staff member is thrilled to see me walk through the front door.
Mm-hmm.
Because normally when the doctor calls us in, you know, they've tried to get certain things to happen, and it just hasn't worked. So we're kind of, in some cases, the big stick that gets things done.
Right.
So I understand that. But, you know, I'm dealing in one office right now, and the opposition that I'm getting from one staff member is just over the top. And that is a very strong warning sign that there may be a hidden agenda.
Right. Very important. And it's funny that you say that, too, because when it's violent resistance, that's the first thing. I mean, everybody's flags go up. I don't mind a little bit of resistance because everybody, you have to have the back of the people on your team. I get that. But when it's violent, I think it's very important to have a healthy conversation around this. So that is huge. What's another indicator that you see consistent?
That this, would be a warning sign. This one's a little more subtle, but a lot of people who are embezzling resist upgrades to their practice management software.
Okay.
Because they have some game that's working now. And they really don't know what horrible thing might be in the upgrade to the software that would stop whatever it is that they're doing. So they tend to be a little resistant there.
What's another indicator?
Another one that we see a lot is that embezzlers tend to be risk takers in their lives. They will do things that are high risk behavior. You know, I'm not necessarily talking about skydiving, but they will do things that involve cutting corners. And where you'll see that in the office is a lot of times the patients will see this person as kind of the fixer who will get things covered for them under insurance that nobody else can seem to, for example.
Like I'm the only person in this office that knows that algorithm, works on behalf of the patient and makes this happen. And
yeah, I mean, this will be the person who would say to the patient, well, you know what, you've almost used your annual coverage for this year or so. If we did that the first of next year, you'd have it covered. It's that thought process. The problem with a lot of the things that I'm laying out, and I'm sure you see this, is that the doctor may view this person as the best employee that they've ever had.
Right.
When I look at the dental population, a fair percentage of them are perfectionists. It's that obsessive compulsiveness that makes them good at what they do. And they see somebody else showing the same traits, and it's very appealing to them. You know, this is somebody who's territorial, who tries to defend me from the minutia of running the office.
Yeah.
It's a paradox here, isn't there?
Yeah. I look at my job and I'm thinking, I got the easy job, but you have a really hard job. Like walk us into the mind or maybe even you don't have to be specific about your story, but like when you go into office, that's a very sticky situation. Like where do you even start? I mean, you don't have to give us your whole process, but I mean, you've got to go in there very carefully. The dentist is probably afraid to say anything. Take us into the psychological makeup of this situation because you fly right into the eye of the storm and I don't know how you do this.
Well, let me tell you our secret.
Okay.
The vast majority of our investigative work is done covertly. So the staff in the office have absolutely no idea that we're involved. And there are a lot of components to that. The biggest one in 2017 is that we're able to do most of this stuff through the cloud.
Right.
So the days when we have to do what I did in that first investigation and go over to the guy's office and sit there with him are pretty much gone.
Right.
And the storm is still there, but in a lot of cases, we're able to do our work without the staff member having any idea that we're doing it.
Right. And let me just piggyback on what you just said a few minutes ago. Let me just say this, because I'm going to be devil's advocate here, because I'm for the team and I'm for the dentist. You know, if you haven't been embezzling, then this is no big deal. As a business owner, you could just say to your team, hey, look, guys, I just really want a healthy practice. So we're going to have a system. You used the word checks and balances, like you used that with me about a year ago. And I like that. It's just a system of checks and balances, make sure everything works. And so periodically, we're just going to have a checkup, you know, and when there's nothing that's considered outside the realm of normal activity, don't worry about it. I mean, we're good, right? But I mean, this is one of those situations where when you're doing the homework and you've got resistance coming up everywhere, I don't even know what I'm trying to say there, but I'm trying to say it delicately. You know, really, as a team, you have nothing to worry about if everything checks out, right?
Let's be clear. The overwhelming majority of team members are honest people who got into working in dental offices for exactly the right reasons. And they have that same altruism that dentists have. And most staff members are horrified at the thought that somebody working with them might be stealing from their boss. So you're absolutely right. Among the huge community of people who are not stealing, there's a lot of support for the idea of smoking out those who are.
Right.
At the same time, our recommendation normally to doctors is that we think you should retain us covertly and not tell your staff, regardless of their current level of honesty, that you decided to check into them. And our methodology is designed to accommodate that. There are situations where we do a more overt look. Sometimes it's not by choice. If, you know, believe it or not, there are still doctors out there using pegboard, right? They have them computerized. And if ever we investigate those, and we do two or three of them a year, there is no way to do it other than put somebody on site. So it's a little tougher in those cases probably to keep it covert. I mean, usually it's a case where we'll end up working a weekend or doing something so that we can still keep it covert.
Yeah, that's so funny. You use the word pegboard. There are so few people that even, I mentioned pegboard and people are like, what is pegboard? I'm like, when I got started in this business, there was such a thing called pegboard.
5% of dental offices still use it.
Really?
Really?
Really? And believe it or not, it works. I mean, we could actually do a whole different show. I know. No, I'm not going to go
there. I mean, sure, it works. Just like salt works to cauterize a wound. But
absolutely. There's better ways of doing things now. Yeah. So keep going. Like, these indicators are important. What are some other indicators that you see typically?
Another observation that I'll make is that honest people don't have to keep repeatedly telling you or showing you how honest they are. And if anybody in the audience wants a visual example of this, think back to the last time that you bought a car from a dealer. And I'm sure the salesman told you three times that he was the most honest car salesman in whatever your city was. Okay. When you start hearing that from somebody, get a firm grip on your wallet because it's about to be attacked. So staff members who will make a point repeatedly of telling you about how honest they are, look out.
Yeah. And then let's dig a little bit deeper here too, because you and I have had this conversation. And again, this isn't everybody. We're talking about a very small group of people. It's a disease and it's an addiction in some respects. I mean, you can almost argue that they can't stop. And they start to tell themselves lies that they actually believe. And it becomes something they can't fix. So when somebody starts this, it's not like they go, man, I've been doing this for 2 years. I feel really bad. This is not right. I'm just going to stop cold turkey today. Does that ever happen?
No, it doesn't. You're absolutely right. The pressures that push somebody to steal are pretty powerful ones.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's need or greed, you know, these people are carried along with this in a way that's almost out of their control. So I've never seen anybody stop voluntarily. What causes people to stop is they get caught or they get fired. And other than that, they tend to keep going until they can't steal anymore. And we have this whole category of people we call serial embezzlers. So these are people who steal in one office and they get caught and fired. And the next day they're out hitting the bricks looking for another job, and dentistry is what they understand. So they get hired by another dental office and they steal there and they do the same thing. We actually had one of these who, over the course of about 4 years, worked in 14 different dental offices.
Wow.
And to her, dentistry was like the flame to the moth. She just couldn't stay away. And one of the encouragements I'd like to give your audience is that I find dentists in general do a terrible job of screening people when they hire them.
Right.
I've asked thousands of dentists in live audiences, can I just see a show of hands of how many of you enjoy the hiring process? I was speaking in Rhode Island the day before yesterday, 50 people in the audience, no hands went up, and that's typical. They absolutely hate the idea of hiring people, which means a couple of things. You know, they don't necessarily fire people when they should, because if they do, they have to go through that process again.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that when they are hiring and they find a candidate who looks perfect to them, every ounce of skepticism that should be in their brain just vanishes and mistakes get made. And we see these people called serial embezzlers, and there are a lot of them out there.
You know, and I would imagine for a lot of dentists, they don't prosecute when this happens because it's embarrassing, correct? And so these people, somebody that works in 14 different offices probably doesn't have that much of a criminal record, or does, you know? So how would that happen, David?
In that case, she did. And the embezzler I'm talking about went to prison for 2 years and then resumed her wicked ways. And that information was all very public. In fact, she'd been in the media.
Okay. So let's create a treatment plan. If you interview someone who's been to prison, don't have a second interview. So that's item number one.
Well, item number two is, let's find out if they've been in prison or otherwise had a problem. I mean, I have a simple rule. When a dentist is hiring somebody, they should speak to all former employers for the last 5 years. Let's bear in mind, though, Kirk, that we may have an embezzler who doesn't want you to do that. So they will play with the dates that they work for people on their resume. Okay. They will give phone numbers on their resume for former employers that are actually a disposable cell phone that their aunt has.
Wow.
Who will answer it and give a great reference as if they were the former employer.
That blows my mind, and I can see how easy that would be. So an important point, make sure the phone number is actually the business.
All phone numbers that you call when you're verifying should be ones that you found independently and didn't come from the applicant.
That's powerful.
But it doesn't even stop there. Here's an easy one. Let's say I got fired last week for stealing, and now I'm applying at your office. The first thing I'm going to say to you is, Dr. Barron, my current employer doesn't know I'm leaving, so please don't call her.
Wow.
And you, being an altruist like most dentists are, will say, okay, I understand.
Yeah.
And then that conversation with the employer who just fired me will never happen, and I'll get the job with you. And what happens next is pretty predictable.
Wow. Like you're opening the door to the things that we don't think about. Because it's our relationships, it starts on trust. You're like, I like this person. We're going to establish trust. And so I'm going to follow your lead.
You said this very early on in the conversation. Very few dentists chose that profession out of a burning desire to be small business owners. That is simply the curse that comes with the privilege of doing what they love to do, which is give people beautiful smiles.
Right.
For them, the business part is something they never wanted. And it's just the necessary evil. The second thing about dentists is when you look at how they work with each other, you know, like a relationship between a general dentist and a specialist, it is a very trusting, very much put the patient's interest first kind of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that serves them really well inside that clinical bubble and really poorly once they get out of it and dealing with the rest of the world who don't share that same code of ethics. And that's what gets them caught. They just assume that everybody is as straight a shooter as they are, and the rest of the world doesn't always work that way. Another statistic you may not have thought about is that 65 million Americans, in other words, 1 in 4 adults, has a criminal record.
Really? I did not know that.
So when you're interviewing an applicant for a job, there's a discernible chance that they have baggage. And we need to be a little more vigilant. I mean, another simple question I ask dentists in live presentations, how many of you check the photo ID of somebody you're about to hire?
The photo ID?
Yeah.
Tell me why. Oh, the driver's license. Okay.
Or something. Driver's license and credit card. So we're bringing somebody into next to our house, probably the most sacred, special place in our life, where there's lots of money that comes in. There's lots of confidential information, like protected health information, that's there. Mm-hmm. And in most offices, there's access to prescription medications. And we bring somebody into that. And at the end of the day, we really have no idea who they are. Of course, there are lots of fake IDs out there. So asking for photo ID is not foolproof with somebody. But it's a really basic step that just doesn't even dawn on most dentists.
Yeah, that is very interesting. So give us maybe one or two more indicators. And then I want to go into what a dentist can do to prevent this from happening. So what are maybe one or two more indicators? I know if people want to take the actual assessment, you've offered this to the viewers, and I'm so grateful for this. You can actually take it for free. Normally, you charge $75 to take the test, but this link you said will be up until July 1st. Okay, so we'll leave it up till July 1st. So if you want to just take the test as a preventive measure, great. But what are some of the other things that you would see as indicators?
Sure. And I should mention, just on the subject of the test, we call it the Embezzlement Risk Assessment Questionnaire. It's done online. The link that Kirk is mentioning will take you right there. It's 37 questions and will take a typical dentist 10 to 15 minutes to complete. They're easy questions. They're yes or no.
Okay.
Okay. And at the end, you get a score. And the score will let you benchmark where you stand relative to the rest of the people who take the test. For example, a score of 60 or higher indicates that you have an extreme risk of embezzlement. So that's where we're now seeing 5 to 7 behaviors or more that are correlated with embezzlement.
Wow.
So to answer your question about indicators, I mentioned this one before, but a lot of staff members who are embezzling will be reluctant to take vacation. A lot of times to keep embezzlement going requires control over the flow of information in the office. So we may get patients phoning with sort of weird questions. And the embezzler really is the person who wants to field that question, and they can make it go away so that the patient doesn't have a need to bring it up with the doctor. Another one is that a lot of embezzlers want alone time when they steal. So they don't want to do it in the day when everybody else, including the doctor, is around. So they will come in early, or they will stay late, or they'll come in on Saturdays, but they want to be in the office by themselves. So that's another fairly strongly linked indicator.
Right. So, and again, it just bears repeating, we don't want to create any challenges within anybody's office. But if I'm a young dentist watching this, David, where should I start so this never happens or I prevent it from happening? Where would I start?
Well, the topic of prevention is one that's near and dear to my heart. And I hear a lot of people talking about embezzlement prevention. And I think the problem sometimes that people have is they don't really understand this crime or how it's different from other crimes. Let me talk about prevention and whether it's realistic or not.
Okay.
Then we'll talk about what I think people should do about embezzlement.
Love it.
What almost everybody does is they draw what they understand from other types of crime and they want to apply it to embezzlement. And there's a really fundamental limitation. So I suspect that most of your audience have some kind of alarm system on their house.
Mm-hmm.
Alarm systems are very effective. If I'm a house burglar and I'm walking down your street, and I get to your front door and I see the alarm system, that's probably going to push me off onto your neighbor.
Right.
And from that perspective, they work really well. But let's look at what happens there. We didn't actually prevent crime with the alarm system. We simply redistributed it. In other words, if we look at a given community, alarm systems don't change the overall burglary rate. They just affect who it happens to. The difference between a house burglar and an embezzler is that a burglar can choose his victim. So if I am walking down your street and I find your alarm system, that doesn't send me home to join the church choir and live a life of honesty. I'm still a burglar, but I just hit your neighbor instead. With embezzlement, though, the victim is predetermined. So if I work for you, you're the only possible victim I have. I've yet to meet the embezzler who will decide, well, it's just too hard to steal from Dr. Behrendt, so I'll quit my job with him, I'll get a job down the street, and I'll invest the 2 years that it takes me to understand the new doctor's systems well enough and build up enough trust that I can steal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm stuck with you.
Right.
So what I have control over, and therefore what you can influence, is not my choice of victim, it's my choice of methodology. What people tend to do is have an oversimplified view of the embezzler. And they assume that if they can just think ahead of the embezzler, in other words, anticipate the way I might steal from them and then put some control measure in place that blocks it, that they will prevent embezzlement.
Yeah. So what you're saying is there's no template for this. This is a very dynamic relationship that will move in almost like an amoeba. It'll go in different directions.
I describe embezzlement sometimes as a crime of navigation. Every embezzler starts the same way. They look around. They look at what their doctor looks at, and more importantly, what he or she doesn't. And they target those areas. So if you are somebody who every day diligently compares the day-end report from your software with the deposit that's going into the bank, and I work for you, I know that. So I'm not going to do some type of embezzlement that will create a mismatch between the deposit and the day-end report, because in that structure, that will get me caught. What I'll be thinking about instead is, how can I steal money inside the practice management software so that the day-end report and the deposit line up with each other, but there's still money missing?
Right. Which we see a lot.
So embezzlers start by looking at your control systems. And when I get calls from doctors who've been embezzled, I mean, they're doing a lot of this. They're seeing how the staff member did it, and they're saying to themselves, I should have looked at that. And my answer to them is, okay, but what would the embezzler's response have been if you had been looking at that? It wouldn't put them in the church choir. It would encourage them to steal some other way.
Yeah. Can I add one thing, David? Because I'm having these epiphanies. I'll just say this as a business owner. Like, I say this to my team all the time. Like, your team members that you trust the most, that do the best, you never think about them. They never come into your mind. You know, I say to some of my team members, like, I never think about you. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just don't have to worry about you. Like, you do your job so well that I don't think about you from day to day. Most of your energy goes to those components of your business that aren't working so well. So maybe you have a chairside assistant that's not coming along. So all of your energy and your thought process is like, especially as a dentist, I got to fix this part of my business. That one's working pretty well. I'm not going to give it any energy. Is that correct?
It's correct. And let's go further into that. That chairside assistant is working right beside you. So whatever shortcomings are in her performance are very visible to you.
Right.
And also what she's doing is probably a lot closer to what you're interested in the practice than what the people at the front desk are doing. Every dentist has the same vision of their utopia.
Mm-hmm.
And their utopia is that they come in today and they do high-end dentistry that pays really well. And then they go home and the business part of the practice runs itself.
Right.
They kind of almost measure their success or failure and how often they get dragged into solving problems with the business part of their practice. I meet very few dentists who say, I want to spend more time running my business and less time in my operatory. So that's their desire. And embezzlers offer the promise of that practice utopia.
Mm-hmm.
Because the embezzler has a common interest with the doctor. I mean, they want the doctor less involved in running the business as well.
Right.
Because that lets them steal. So the embezzler exudes competence. You know, doctor, you go and do what you're good at, and I'll take care of everything else. And to most doctors, that is very sweet music.
Yeah. And it's sweet music that can be very healthy. Like, it can be. And, you know, everybody wants that. So David, what do I do? Again, I'm just going to constantly, we have so many young dentists watching. We got a lot of dentists in their early 30s watching this and even under 30. So let's say I don't even have a practice, or let's say I'm starting a practice. You know, what are my steps? And then I'll even speak for the dentists that are a little bit mature, because I've got a dear friend of mine. He is truly one of the best business owners. He's a dentist, brilliant, happened a second time. Now, I just saw him. He's like, buddy, you don't know how hard this is. Like, I am a student of business in dentistry. He teaches this. He goes, a second time. He goes, you know how hard emotionally it is to come back from, like, it's so hard. And he said this, I have plenty of money saved. You know, it's like at this stage of my career, I shouldn't be in this position. So take us through that, David. Give us a treatment plan from here forward.
You nailed something beautifully. There is very little correlation between the doctor's business acumen or the amount of time and effort they spend running their business and their propensity to be embezzled. Embezzlement really starts with the embezzler. And this is somebody who wakes up one morning and for their own reasons decides that they're going to steal from you. And then they use the knowledge they have of how your office operates to pull it off. The difference that business acumen and effort make is that the people who are switched on to those things catch the embezzler a lot quicker. We've seen embezzlement that's gone on for 10 years, but the business-oriented dentist will catch it a lot more quickly.
Okay.
And it happens to everybody. And really, that what's driving the statistics has very little to do with the victim and a lot to do with the criminal.
Right.
So what to do about it? Well, the first thing I want to talk about is how people in general, including dentists, approach the concept of trust. And I think everybody can relate to this when I say, when you meet somebody, you want to decide relatively quickly on, can I trust them?
Mm-hmm.
And once you make that decision, you don't ever want to revisit it.
Right.
So as a society, we view trust as a one-time assessment that should be good forever. And there are two problems with that. The first is that sometimes our ability to make this assessment is flawed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to make this conversation political, but I will say that a lot of people voted for a certain president who now probably wish they could change their vote. And it was perhaps a case of misassessment. The second thing is that people's situation changes. So there may be somebody who is worthy of your trust today who might not be next year or 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned the serial embezzlers. The other cohort we see are people who work for an office for a very long time, and one day they start stealing. I was dealing with a case recently where the office manager had been working in the office for 28 years before she started stealing. So one of the first messages I will give, particularly to your younger cohort, is that they really need to change a little bit about how they think about trust. And they have to recognize that it needs to be a fluid concept. In other words, we need to be reevaluating trust and saying, can I still trust this person?
Yeah. Can I piggyback on that too? Because sure. Our whole entire team, if you haven't read this book, you have to read this book. It's called The Advantage by Patrick Lencioni. And he's profiled the best businesses and leaders in the world. And they all consistently work on the most important piece of the entire pyramid, which is trust. And we refer to it, and I think about it as a moving score, like it's a score. Yeah. Even with your spouse, your trust isn't always at a 10. It moves based on kind of like an average of recent scores of interactions type of thing. So when you say fluid, I mean, it's one of those things. And you know this, if you're a dentist watching this, you can see the trust drop in your team by not having team meetings. You know, you're not talking to them. Now you're just closing your door and you're getting mad. They're not like, oh, we totally trust her. We totally trust him. We're good. You know, you've got to constantly invest and be invested in that relationship.
Absolutely. Great advice. And my point again is that we need to, despite the fact that this goes against a lot of human nature, we need to reevaluate periodically whether people still merit our trust or not. So that's the first thing. I've already talked about hiring, and the one case where I think we have the chance to really prevent embezzlement is not to hire embezzlers. We just need to do a better job of being a little bit cynical. I mentioned that 1 in 4 adults has a criminal record. I'll throw out another statistic, and I've seen various numbers on this, but most of them suggest the same thing, that more than 50% of resumes have some level of falsehood.
Oh, yeah. I would agree with that.
So when a dentist looks at a resume, they need to be a little bit forensic. And I'll give you an example. You know, when people claim to have been out of the workforce, there are two possibilities. One is that they really did stay home with their kids or travel through Europe. Or the other is that there's a job there that they don't want you to know about, because if you phone the person who hired them, that person's going to say some things that will result in them not getting the job with you.
Right.
So one of the takeaways from this is that any claim that somebody was out of the workforce needs to be proven. Somebody says to you, well, you know, I wasn't working for that 9 months. I was traveling through Europe. What needs to be in the doctor's mind is, well, maybe that was true. Maybe they, and this isn't limited to embezzlement. I mean, maybe this was a hygienist who got fired because she was using the same Profi cup all morning.
Right. I would ask you a question on that, because if you're watching this and you've never hired or you haven't had a lot of experience hiring, for 25 years, David, we've been taught when you call a former employer, you ask one question. What's the question that you're supposed to ask?
Would you rehire that person?
Yes. Now, is that still true as applicable advice?
Absolutely. And the beauty of that question is that anything other than a yes is a no.
Tell me why.
If you have a former employer who was great, and somebody phones you and says to you, would you rehire them? Of course, you're going to say yes. In fact, you might say, I didn't even know they were looking for a job. Thank you for telling me. I'm going to call them now and try and...
Or I always say this, I would hire that person back in a second. I am devastated she left, but you've got an incredible asset coming to you. Don't even think about it. Hire her.
If you had a good employee, that would be what you would say.
Right.
So... now let's look at a scenario where you're phoning somebody and they say, well, I don't want to answer that question. Or there's just a 5-second pause on the phone. Or there's hell no.
Mm-hmm.
Any of those things mean the same thing.
Because legally, they can say that. They can't say anything about the person's performance or anything specific legally, correct?
It's probably a little more murky than that. But the danger that you run if you say that that person stole from me is... the court process moves maddeningly slowly. So if you fire somebody for embezzlement today, it will be years before they will see the inside of a courtroom, if ever.
Right.
So you fire somebody and you get a call next week and you say they stole from me. And then later on, that person goes to court and gets acquitted. Okay. Now, as the law treats it, they didn't actually steal from you and you said that they did.
Mm-hmm.
There's a retroactive element to this. And arguably, you have committed the crime of slander. which opens you up to civil action against them. So the reason for the existence of this question is that when you answer it, you're talking not about somebody's past behavior, but about your future intentions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's much safer. So you don't need a team of attorneys to decide if it's okay to answer that question. And if you want to give a negative on somebody about that question, the easiest thing to say is, my attorney has advised me not to answer that question about that employee.
Wow, that's a really good response.
You're not saying anything that will ever get you sued, but you're conveying a very clear message to the next employer that, you know, you better think really hard about this one.
Right. If you're watching that, write that one down. That is a huge keeper. Great one.
My attorney has advised me not to answer that question. And whether it's true or not, what you're telling the next employer is that something bad happened here and I'm just not going to talk about it.
Right. But I'm guessing this phone call is never going to happen anyway. But if it does, you know, an embezzler is going to be smarter than that. They're not going to open themselves up to this kind of.
Yeah, but, you know, they have to apply for a job somewhere and they have former employers. And if you can find out who their former employers are, which won't necessarily come from them, and you ask this question, as I say, anything other than a raving yes is a no.
Wow, that is powerful. So what else can I do if I'm watching this? What's just proactive, preventive things that I can do?
Let me give you a very simple one. I love this one because it's a minimal time investment for potentially a huge return.
Okay.
Almost every office has an alarm system. Mm-hmm. HIPAA almost requires it these days. And you know what? Every alarm company now is pretty computerized.
Right.
So if the doctor asks, one thing the alarm company can do every month is send an email to the doctor's private email with the alarm log. So this shows the comings and goings in the month. Who disarmed the alarm and when, and who armed it and when.
Right. And they can get individual little key codes that let them in the door that does a timestamp on when they came and went, right?
So if you look at your access log and you see that somebody is coming in on Saturday afternoons, that should raise a lot of suspicion with you. Because certainly if a staff member is coming in after hours, you probably should already know about it. And you should have satisfied yourself that the reasons for that are valid. The employee who comes in and works on Saturday afternoons, particularly one who doesn't claim the hours for payroll purposes, is pretty scary. So if people want a quick fix, and it's not the only thing they should be doing by any stretch, but one where the ratio of potential payoff to time is huge, check that alarm log every month.
Right. And could you apply the same thing to cloud access or not?
Yes, you could.
Okay. So if I'm a team member or if I'm a dentist and other team members have access to the cloud, how do you do that? I'm not a techie.
The company that does your software should be able to send you a report each month.
So but basically what you're saying is set up an automatic report, comes every month that shows you when people came and went. And then also on your software, when people logged in and logged out, and just look for any irregular activity.
We're looking for the outliers, the ones that are outside the bracket of normal office time. What some alarm companies will do, and I think this is pretty intriguing, you can arrange with some companies so that they will send you a text message if somebody comes into your office at a time that is outside a bracket that you set. So, you know, your office is open 9 to 5. You say, all right, I'm not interested in people coming in after 8 p.m. or leaving before 6. But if somebody comes in at 7 o'clock at night, or as we've seen sometimes, you know, 11 o'clock on a Friday night, text me. And they send a text to the doctor's phone, and then you can decide if this is something you want to dig into a little further.
That's brilliant. And it's automated. And I'm just going to go right there because I go into dental offices and a lot of them have the eye in the sky. Do you know what I mean? It's a little camera. Now, my first thought is that is just like a severe violation of trust. It used to be. And now you see it in almost every business. Is that something that you recommend? Is it something you not recommend? But if I'm doing this anyway, that's not going to stop me. The eye in the sky, correct? Or would you?
There's good and bad to the eye in the sky. I'm in favor of them, but for a lot of reasons other than embezzlement.
Right.
For example, Kirk, some dentists have been unfairly accused of, you know, giving a patient nitrous and then groping.
Right. I got it.
It's great for that. It's great for any event where the time of the event can be isolated.
Right.
You know, the other thing is that there have been lots of burglaries of dental offices by people who are posing as a lab courier. Mm-hmm. So they come in the front door. And if somebody's there, they leave the lab case.
Right.
If somebody's not there, they walk out with the front desk computer. The camera's great for that because again, you can usually pinpoint within a few minutes when the computer vanished, and you can look at the video footage,
right,
and see what happened. The problem with using cameras to look for embezzlement is that embezzlement can happen anytime.
Mm-hmm.
So if your office is open 32 hours a week and you need two cameras to watch the front desk, you're shooting 64 hours of the front desk video a week.
Wow.
When are you going to watch it?
Never.
Never. So cameras have their uses. The other thing is, you know, there are situations where a doctor gets suspicious and puts in cameras and then we can find something.
Mm-hmm.
But as a sort of vanilla monitoring device, they're not much good.
Right. So if I'm hearing this correctly, you and I are going to do a lot of these. And again, please hear this. I'm just going to say it over and over. This is not to create a barrier between you and your team. If anything, I hope you're watching this and say, you know this as a dentist, we have got to all come together. We have to have a high level of trust and interdependence with each other to pull this off. And I think, David, what I'm hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm watching this, I'm just thinking, I'm a 32-year-old dentist. I'm just going to make this super simple on myself. I'm going to do a checkup once a year. No different than getting screened for cancer, getting a mammogram. I'm just going to get screened once a year, just make sure everything's good. Would that be a pretty reasonable, simple treatment plan? Because this is a dynamic, very dynamic thing.
It is. Like every dentist, I'm a little reluctant to treat an asymptomatic patient.
Right.
So we have people who call us and say, you know, I'd like you to come do an audit each year.
Mm-hmm.
And our answer is, if you want, we will.
Okay.
But it's not normally what we recommend. What we'd suggest is we do an audit now and we set you up with some monitoring tools, the biggest one of which is that embezzlement risk assessment questionnaire that we've been talking about. So once we have a baseline, let's let you repeat the questionnaire periodically. If your score is climbing, we'll absolutely come and do another audit. But we're not convinced that it's the best use of your money to have us back over and over again in the absence of any symptoms.
Right. So this is almost like a PSA test. Let's just, you know, see where the score is at, and then we don't do anything unless it's high.
And then we're looking for changes. Absolutely. The other thing I'll mention is that we have another product called FraudGuard.
What is that?
And FraudGuard is quite different from embezzlement investigation. When we do embezzlement investigation, we're looking at transactions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're looking for the kinds of things that thieves do when they're trying to hide what they stole. When we do FraudGuard for a practice, we don't look at transactions at all. But what we look at is the processes in the office.
Mm-hmm.
We key on embezzlement hotspots. There are about 27 different things that we look at.
Okay.
And it's everything from what the doctor looks at the end of each month and each year to how people are screened before they're hired.
Okay.
So what we do is we help teach the doctor how to set up systems in their office that are going to not prevent embezzlement, because I don't think there's such a thing, mm-hmm. but make it detectable quickly. Force embezzlers to choose high-risk methods of stealing instead of fairly safe ones, things like that.
Right.
And really what we're trying to do is mean that if it happens, the doctor will know about it quickly and it will be dealt with before, you know, it causes multiple organ failure, to use your disease analogy.
Mm-hmm. Buddy, this is so great. So we're going to break this up into a couple shows, because I know that there's a lot of other facets to this that I really want to explore. And I really like the psychology behind it and just the why. You know, I'm a big fan of why this all happens in the first place. And then obviously we'll talk about the how. But here's what I'm going to suggest, David, if this is okay. So your company is called Prospera Dent. And what do you do? Like, what does Prospera Dent do?
First of all, we only work with dentists. We currently have 15 investigators, some of whom are subspecialized. So for example, we have an orthodontic department, because the software that orthodontists use and the business model is different enough from general dentists that we need our own specialized investigators to work with them.
Right.
So then we do four things. First of all, we investigate in cases where people have suspicion. We investigate in cases where people have already found embezzlement, and that's a little different approach. We do our FraudGuard engagements, and we have different sort of scopes. I mean, we have FraudGuard that's designed for a solo practice or two dentist kind of offices. And then we have a very different FraudGuard product that's designed for the owner of 5 or 10 or 20 practices. And then finally, we do some kind of non-standard stuff. This might be, for example, where a dentist bought a practice and believes that what she was told about the practice in terms of finances and stuff wasn't true. And her attorney wants us to develop some facts about the misstatement and be able to be acting as an expert witness in a litigation process.
Okay.
So we have a department that's oriented to support litigation.
Wow. I did not know that, buddy. It's awesome. Yeah,
it's the quiet part, but it's also staffed with some of our most experienced investigators, and they do some really interesting things.
Yeah. You're like the black ops guy that goes in and just like figures out what to do, and no one knows you. And well, and you know, it's for the betterment of making all this healthy. So I'm going to say this, at the very least, David has been so kind to let us use his risk assessment questionnaire for free. It's right to the side here in the feed. Just click on it and take it. It takes what? Just a couple minutes? Right. 3-4 minutes?
15 minutes maximum.
15 minutes. Okay.
And it is time incredibly well spent.
Yes, and I would agree. So just take the test. It's 15 minutes. It's a screening. That's it. And then if you have further questions, David, how can they get a hold of you? I'm going to suggest this. David, you're on Facebook, right? So just ask the questions in the feed, because I'm sure if you're watching the show, if you have questions, please ask them in the feed, because I would love to see the answer that David is going to propose. And if you have a confidential question, they can just call Prosperity and ask you confidentially, correct?
Absolutely. Our website is easy to remember. It's dentalembezzlement.com.
Okay.
And I'm sure most of your literate audience knows that embezzlement has two Z's.
Yes, it does. It does.
And our toll-free phone number is 888-398-2327.
Awesome, buddy. Hey, buddy, I am so grateful that you would share your wisdom, insight, and expertise. So thank you. And like I said, I would do a couple more of these with you.
It was a lot of fun, and I'll come back anytime.
Yeah. So again, I really don't want you, if you're watching this, to, you know, watch it in anger or fear or anything like this. I want you to think about this and say, look, I'm a business owner. I've got to be proactive. I'm responsible for the overall health of this practice. And I want you, if anything, just to be proactive and just say, look, I'm going to proactively make sure that this doesn't happen, because I can tell you firsthand, and David could too, the ripple effect is way beyond anything you could ever get your brain around when it happens the first time. And it's twice as bad, if not three times as bad, when it happens a second time. So let's not let that happen to you. So David, again, thank you so much. I'm so grateful. I'm thanking you for watching this. We are having so much fun watching these shows. So if you're watching these shows, do me a favor and you find them valuable. One huge favor, hit the share button, tell your friends. We would love to have a chance to help your friends. And then if there's ideas or questions that you have about future shows, we've got a ton of them lined up with some incredible industry leaders coming up. Please send them to us and I'll make it happen. Thank you for watching. And until we see you next time, have an awesome day. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Kirk. Awesome.